Well, I've welcomed practically everybody in the room before, but some of you have arrived since the brief introduction that we had at 3 o'clock.
Is that called that? I don't know.
Madam Secretary, most people here are frequent visitors, frequent flyers. Shall I do the fire bit for you? Yeah. Anybody who isn't a regular here and hasn't already heard it 28 times, please do sign in and out. Otherwise, we have to send Paul round the building hunting for you if there's a fire alarm. And secondly, if a fire alarm goes off, please go out the door in the rain, round the corner, and stand in the rain in the mews so that we can check that you're actually out of the building, because we take the book and check you off. So that's sort of the gist of the thing. Now, it falls to my sad duty to report to you that Derek Nathan sadly passed away at the weekend on the 10th. So perhaps we should be quiet for a minute. Thank you. There's a card on the table here for the family. Perhaps you, those who are his friends, would like to sign, could do so afterwards. I am asked to advise you the funeral will be tomorrow morning at 12 noon, or at least tomorrow at 12 noon. I cannot say tomorrow morning at 12 noon at Putney Vale Cemetery. Some of us have been rather sadly frequent visitors there, but I know you will be appreciated if you are able to attend. Now, would the Honorary Secretary do the honours to new first-time visitors and things?
Thank you, Mr. President. We have 75 fellows and members this afternoon and 6 guests who are very welcome. So thank you for joining us. We have 2 new members that have signed in, but unfortunately they had to sign out as well and go away, disappear rather early. So we'll call them out. We'll greet them next time that they come. Is there anybody else that is a new member today, or is their first visit today? Anybody, or anybody from overseas? We don't seem to have any overseas today.
They don't print overseas.
They don't want to know about printing.
It's too complicated. They have to understand the English.
He didn't say that. Please don't quote him. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, introducing Jeff is a bit like introducing your grandfather or your uncle or something, because actually everybody knows him. I think everybody knows that by training and profession and private interest, he's essentially a scientist. And a man of very considerable knowledge, who also has worked immensely hard for the society, and I'm delighted to say, not only set out his own display, or backed up his own display with the museum downstairs, but made it much more interesting, visible, and understandable for everybody who comes into the building. It is now there to be seen and appreciated. Jeff, I don't know how long ago I saw your first piece, or not your first piece, but the first piece you showed me on printing methodology, but we rapidly agreed that it was something that should be shared here with the membership, and I'm very pleased that you're doing it. Jeff has broken a number of traditions, as I explained earlier, and I won't go through that again, but he is now going to, as it were, read or give us the main part of his paper, but perhaps not at greater length than the first part, which we've already enjoyed. Jeff, it's over to you. Lights, please.
That means we can be quick, Jeff, because we all need a drink. no more so than myself. Well, there are some slides in this part of the display that are the same as in the first part, and I'll just flick through them and not discuss them. I apologise to those of you who haven't seen them, but I think I might talk too long otherwise. So I'm talking now specifically about engraving and stamp printing. And so I went through this before about the requirements of being able to make a stamp design that couldn't be forged and duplicate it many, many times and print it very cheaply. And I did discuss the different types of printing, intaglio, letterpress and lithograph, which most of you are conversant with. So I'm being very quick now. This is something I'd like you to remember very carefully, that engraving and intaglio, or intaglio if you wish to pronounce it like that, are not synonyms. Engraving is a method by which you put an image onto some substance, whether it's going to be used for printing or just for decoration of the back of a watch or something like that. Whereas intaglio is a method of printing where the ink is taken from the recesses in the printing form. And we dealt with the different kinds of printing, and I'll get on very quickly because now we're going to discuss in particular the use of engraving in stamp production, and I'm going to deal with some aspects in a little bit of detail on the production of the background to the penny black, and by background I mean this area here, not necessarily the white lines, but I'm going to discuss the white lines because these are areas where there has been, on occasions, some rather unfortunate things written about how the background was done, and it's a very simple background, and some rather dreadful things about how the white lining was done, so I will explain that, I hope, satisfactorily for you. Just a reminder what a wood engraving looks like. Here, the part of the image that is not to print is removed, and what is left behind is inked letterpress and printed in an ordinary letterpress print. And the artist who did that is in the room with us here. She is the elegant lady in pink, if you want to find her. Now, to remind you again, those who weren't here, we're talking to some degree about the mill and die process developed by Jacob Perkins. And this was a means by which he could reproduce the same pattern many, many times, and a means by which he could make corrections to the engraved die. You see, you think about this. It's about a quarter of an inch thick of steel. It's not like the days of engraving a copper plate, when if you made a mistake, you turned the plate over and hammered it from the back and hammered the image out and then re-engraved it. It's somewhat more difficult to correct a piece of steel like that. You don't hammer it from the back. And so his mill and die process enabled that to be done, and at the same time enabled him to produce a means of duplicating the image many, many times. So this is I'm not used to this thing, you know. I'll get there. This is a head die for the 3/2, which they were trying to produce a letterpress printing form for it rather than the intaglio form that they had used before. Excuse me, is it too boomy still, Paul? No, okay. I'm just more conscious of hearing my own voice than I was in the previous part of the talk. So the process essentially involves engraving the die by these stages here. And this is how they produced some of the samples for the 1879 tender. They had a very large stock of transfer rollers, and this is a transfer roller of a head, but they had a large stock of transfer rollers with various backgrounds on them. So the first thing that is done is that you take your steel die, which is soft, and you roll in the background, and you see the background rolled into the soft die here. So the lines are recessed into the surface of the die. So this could be inked and printed in intaglio. Then you draw out the outline of the stamp, as you see drawn here. Then the question is, how do you remove all this junk round the back? You can't scrape it away because it's below ground level. So you can scrape it away much easier if it were above ground level to bring the rest of the surround down to ground level, so to speak. So you pick that up on a transfer roller. So the transfer roller is similar to the one with the head on here and is rolled across that die after it has been hardened. And it's a form of case hardening that they used. And it was rather an intriguing mechanism by which they got there. But you harden the die, then you roll a soft roller over it. Now you've got the inverse of the image. The image that's engraved there and was recessed is now standing up proud on the roller. So then you can take your scraper and scrape all the highs that you don't want, namely all that background, and finish up with something like this here. And you can scrape out the outline of the head. Don't ask me how they drew that outline in, because I just don't know how he did that. So these are prints that were made by my friend in the room here and his former print technician. I was given a very onerous job. I was allowed to clean the dies with nitromores. And it seemed to dissolve the protective gloves I was wearing as well. And my dermatitis has never been better. So we have this primary dye here. Then we have the second stage of the secondary dye. After it's been cleaned up, the roller is then hardened and it's rolled back into the dye here. And some lettering was engraved in. And so it continues. Now, we haven't, unfortunately, got the transfer roller image of the head, but this is the die of that head there. So I did a little bit of computer jiggling and produced the head in red that I effectively have rolled in. So they will produce all the top part here and then roll in from another transfer roller the head. Now, you have to roll this very carefully, because you don't want to squash out the stuff around the side. Now, remember, the image is recessed now into this die, so it's not as if it was standing up. You're not going to flatten it straight away. But it must be an extremely delicate process how this was done. And this was the art and skill that Jacob Perkins developed from the early 1820s onwards. Now, this shows you how you make a correction to a die. So here we have a head die that they were not happy with what was happening here. And you see it's all been scraped down. And then when it's scraped down, you harden the die and then roll the die, harden the roller, then roll the roller into a die and then re-engrave it. And this is the roller that resulted. When they picked it up from the re-engraved die, they picked up on this roller, but they're still obviously not happy with the hair around here. We seem to have endless roller images with corrections taking place on them. It's sometimes very hard to find the final roller, and this is because we were just given all the ironwork that Perkins Bacon had left behind. I think it was the Metal Box Company, wasn't it, who eventually, is that right, that were the eventual owners of the Perkins Bacon. This shows you how the process of rolling the roller over the die here. This is the die, I think, of the 5 shilling or 10 shilling Castle's issue, the first one with the Wilding head on it. And this is showing you making from that roller, then transferring that image. It's a different roller, it's not that roller, but transferring the image from a roller onto a printing cylinder. This is the indexing mechanism here that allows you to space out the stamps all right and everything like that. So it's quite an ingenious process, and Jacob Perkins developed this literally to an art. He produced extremely fine artistic prints entirely from processes such as this. Now we get back to the penny black background and the background of the St. Vincent 5 shilling, the 1880 issue. It is the identical background on both stamps. And we are very fortunate. We have the primary die of the St. Vincent 5 shilling. And here is just a print that I made with my friends, or my friends made with me cleaning. of the primary day of the St. Vincent. And this is a slightly enlarged bit. And if you look very carefully, you can see the outline there and the curve here. And if you look very carefully, you can see the kneeling figure and the other one around here. But it was from this, looking at these prints, that I eventually decided how the background had been done and realised it was extremely trivial and not a wondrous complicated overlapping of images and making moiré patterns that had been proposed before. And it is just a simple sinusoidal wave, and you see it going along here. And they reproduced that wave, drew it once, that sound wave, then phase shift at 72 degrees and drew it again, so you start getting all the in-between ones. And having done that five times, you've then gone around 360 degrees, five times 72, you then displace the image you've got vertically by a small amount and then engrave it all again. You're not changing the amplitude of the wave, you're just vertically displacing it. And they continued doing that until they got the top here. Now, I did this with a little program. And then it looked to me as if it was then a superposition. This was literally, it looked to me as if it were. And so I took two of these and started sliding one over the other, when lo and behold, this pattern arrived. This was the eureka moment. My late wife couldn't quite understand why I was so excited. I'll tell you, I was quite ecstatic because I definitely was getting here, I could see I was getting the right white pattern here. Now, it doesn't look exactly the same because the lines are different thicknesses here, and I might not quite have the spacing of the sine waves exactly the same as he did. So I did this three times, and I think you have to be very miserable if you don't honestly believe that I have reproduced here a fine representation of the background there. Is there anyone in any doubt? If so, please step outside afterwards. But so this was a great triumph, and I was extremely happy that I'd done that. Now, the next question is the question of the white lines. People say, oh, the white lines are engraved on the die. Well, we know if you engrave something on the die, it prints black. So that was the first misconception. Whereas if you're going to print white lines, then the metal has to be at ground level. It's not the pit pattern has to be at ground level. It's not indented in. And you've got to be able to wipe the ink off it to get it white. So how was that done? And the way it was done, from what one can gather from what Perkins wrote, was that he took the image up on a transfer roller, mounted it in one of his engraving lathes, and then as the roller was turning in the chuck, he had an engraving tool that engaged with the roller and was driven by a reciprocating mechanism, so it was moving back sinusoidally. So he was engraving into the roller. So he was taking metal away from the roller so that when the roller was hardened and it was rolled up on the die, you finish with what's been engraved on the roller at ground level, and hence when it's inked and wiped off, it will print white. Now, if you look very carefully, you find that these are not lined up, the pattern on that side and the pattern on this side. And if you think about it, it would have been quite a difficult job having worked out how to get all these patterns on one side to then move to the other side and try and engrave the mirror image. So what I think he probably did was turn the job round in the chuck and start again, but he did have a little problem in getting it aligned when he did the two sides. And you'll notice, if you look at the penny black, that they are not lined up here, the two arches, and likewise on the St. Vincent 5 shilling. So there we are. That wasn't enough. I then had to try and engrave it. And this is where this gentleman, who I'm standing just at the side of here, came into play. And he's been extremely tolerant and remarkably friendly and accommodating. He has a large collection of these machines. And this is a straight line engine. It doesn't work quite the same way that I think Perkins' machine worked. But effectively, what happens, you have your job mounted here, and I brought it with me. And as you turn a handle just down here that you can't see, this screw winds the whole job up in the air, and these counterweights are just to get rid of the backlash in the screw thread. And there is a rubber here, like a finger, that moves over a metal bar which has got this sinusoidal pattern cut in it, or whatever pattern you wish to engrave, and there's a spring that holds everything in contact with it that way, so that as this is wound up, this rubber moves over the pattern and pushes this back and forth. This is the cut-in tool here. You put your thumb on that bit and your fingers around this bit, and you hold it on, turn your handle quite happily, and you engrave a sine wave. And then you continue to do what I did computationally. Well, we didn't quite get there. We can see that it will work, but there are several slight difficulties. This machine was made for engraving pretty objects like this business card, silver business card holder, and this is a sine wave pattern that's repeated out of step by 90 degrees every, 180 degrees every other pattern. So it wasn't, but it looks as if with suitable choice of tool, and I think we do have some way probably to go there, we could finish up by producing this pattern here, and that was the object of this exercise, the first cut. The next one was, how do we do the equivalent of the transfer roller by engraving on the side of the roller and putting this sine wave on? So, oh, you should have noticed that this machine is circa 1940-1950, whereas this one is contemporaneous with Perkins when he was doing the Penny Black. Well, this is a Rose engine, and I don't think it's the kind of machine necessarily that Perkins used, because he wanted somewhat larger amplitude oscillations than one can get here. But this is the rubber, and this finger presses against this pattern on the side here. And it's so arranged that as you turn the handle and the whole mechanism goes round, carrying the job with it, as the rubber pushes up and down on this sine wave here, the whole job moves back and forth and rocks back and forth like this. So you can engrave a sine wave or any other pattern that you've got on your rose, this is called the rose here, onto the cylinder. If you're wanting to engrave on a flat surface, you hold it in the chuck this way and you change the way it works so that the rubber is rubbing on these other bumps here, and you put it not in pumping mode but in rocking mode, and it rocks back and forth like this. Well, we got something that shows the essence of what we're aiming for, and I have them here, which I'll just stand on this soft matting on the table. Please don't drop them on the table. That could cost me my fellowship and various other things. But they're in that envelope there, John, if you wish to get them out. Now, how do you produce something like this? And this is where Jacob Perkins was in his element. See, this image is the negative of that image. It's reversed everything. And from what is written, there are no pictures, unfortunately, it looks as if what he did was to engrave a die, then pick it up on a transfer roller from the die, so he gets this on the roller, and then roll two rollers together. Now, this is the tricky bit, and I didn't mention it with the white line. If you think that most of these cutting tools tend to cut a V-shaped groove, well, if you've inverted that from being a groove to something standing up because you want to get a white line, now you don't want it V-shaped or it's going to be infinitely thin. So it has to have some mechanism, and it must be hard, I presume, David, is it grinding the tools to be able to cut a square bottom on the bottom of the engraved object?
Yeah, I've got boxes of cutters that come from professional
agent
turners.
It's
just about every shape
that you can get, yeah. We probably can do it, but... Yeah, yeah. And then he rolled the two together, so he produces a roller that's got the negative image of that other roller. Then, when you don't press the wrong button, you can roll it in here, and then you roll the negative image in there. But he produces chain patterns alternating positive and negative. There's a fine collection of these prints in the Bodleian Library. I'm sorry this is so grotty, but I took it from a half-tone print because I hadn't the opportunity to go and convince the Bodleian they wanted to give me some nice scans. Now, we've dealt really with intaglio printing from an engraved die. Now we're going to deal with letterpress printing. These are engraved as well. We have this die downstairs. It was used by Charles Whiting to print Henry Cole's submission to the 1839 Treasury competition for the first postage stamp. It's in two pieces, and you can see the two pieces here. And when you look at the coloured bits, the red part is the lower die, and you engrave them both together, then they come apart, and they're inked separately, and then they move together, and then go through the press to be printed. And he said this was the sure way of preventing forgery, because if you're doing it by any other way, you wouldn't get good registration. Of course, the registration is guaranteed mechanically here. Well, this is all engraved, and you see we're engraving with the subject mounted on the chuck this way, with the graver coming in from the side, and the whole thing rocking back and forth. And you see we're engraving what the generic name for these are, trochoids, and this is a close relative to an epicycloid, isn't it? But I'm not sure what you call it when it's on an ellipse. But the machine for and this is some more of his really superb engraving that they did for the Indian stamp papers. This is a dye proof, so it was just all done in one colour. This is the recipe for the ink down at the bottom here. That's May 5th, 1870, that was printed. Here is a partially engraved die for the same stamp, but something went wrong here, so it was rejected. And the Brian Donkin Trust have been very good in letting me get pictures of these. But you can see that it's in two components. You can see the slightly different coloured metal. The thing that amazed me was that it wasn't engraved all the way around, but it's engraved this half, and then they've engraved the top half of that part. And, I mean, one has to wonder how they did this and why. The rather larger features that are obviously not developed from a sine wave were put in by a pantograph, and they used to make, I think, an 8 times or 10 times wooden model of that, and then they have a pantograph for engraving it. All the machinery is now at the Science Museum and not on display, but we are hoping to get our hands on it. I have a video of it being used with a ballpoint pen instead of a graveling, and this is the Donkin Rose engine that was restored by Russell Day at, I think it's now called the Hallam University at Sheffield, but it definitely in its earlier incarnation was known as Sheffield Polytechnic, and that is a superb machine. This is the power unit here. You turn that handle. This thing rocks back and forth. There's this subsidiary drive that goes around this shaft all the way around here, and the engraving tool is on the end here. So you can have the engraving tool spinning as well, and you can offset them. It's a wonderful machine. I made a very early realization of one of those in Meccano when I was about 15. It had both elements of what this has here, and I was very chuffed with it. But look at this, you see. I mean, look at the castings there. It's wonderful. They're like Boulton and Watt steam engines in miniature. You give your arm and a leg to have that in your library, wouldn't you? Now, we are nearing the end, John, and you haven't pinged the thing, thank God. Just to remind you, how a die, an engraved die, is printed is entirely dependent upon how you ink it. And this is the die here, before I cleaned it up with the nitrum ores, and we printed it intaglio here, and you use a very much stiffer ink. You know, the ink was scraped into the engraved image with a plastic spatula and then all polished off. You have to have the special printer's ball of your hand to know how to polish these. You know, the horny hands of myself wouldn't work on that, of course. That's called the artist. And we printed it, and it's looking pretty there. Then, with a very much thinner ink, and rolled up very, very gently. The ink was rolled over the whole surface of the die again, and it was printed once more, but now it's printed letterpress. And that is really all the difference there is between print and engraved dies as letterpress or intaglio. It would be fair to say, though, that if you're engraving a die and you know that the intended printing process is letterpress, then you will engrave some things differently. You will remove more metal in some places than you would do if you were doing it the other way. So the artist or the engraver does have in mind what the printing, the target printing mechanism is. And there we are. Have I kept to the half hour, boss?
You have indeed.
Well done. Thank you very much.
So, there, ladies and gentlemen, you have the ups and the downs of printing.
Sorry about that. Or
maybe the stiffer ink and the lighter ink. Jeff, thank you very much. I think you've entertained and taught us a lot today, and I'm sure it's well appreciated. Now, we debated a little while ago the process of thanking our speakers, because, as you all know, it's been our tradition to thank our speakers. And we decided that rather than have two votes of thanks, we would have one vote of thanks in future, because it was becoming, shall we say, sometimes a little repetitive, or the second person found the first person had said everything he wanted to say. So, if I may, I'm going to call on Gavin Fryer to do the whole job. And, Gavin, it's over to you. Thank you very much.
Mr. President, Geoffrey Ivor Kane, fellows, members and guests, this has been quite an education for some of us, I suspect. And I think Geoffrey's been very brave to take on the whole of printing of stamps, and indeed other things as well, and the host of methods that have been used in the past.
Yes, please.
I also hope that some of you have been downstairs to the basement and seen what's available in the museum, because a lot of work's gone on down there, for which Geoffrey's been responsible. And it's complementary to this afternoon's two talks and display. And what these demonstrate is how engraving of metal, or indeed wood, has been applied to production of adhesives. The principal aim was to create the printing base for mass production of huge quantities of the same image, billions, even trillions, at reasonable cost, and at the same time maintain sufficient security of the product. And some of the techniques we've heard about are designed to maintain security. Now, I understand that Jeff may well not have entered the field of philately, because he became fascinated by print. He collects books on printing and printers. And he collected maps to study how they were made. Only later did he collect stamps in a mistaken belief that they were more cheap to buy than maps. But he's learning fast. Anyway, we benefit from Jeff's study and knowledge of printing, including electronic form and its application. And he's gained this over 38 years. Now, from time to time, Jeff's interest has been stimulated by remarks from friends such as, "Have you obtained one of these yet?" And you show him something, and he goes off and he does a bit more homework. And here we've seen engraving coupled with letterpress, printing, lithography and planography, as developed for illustrations over 300 years, collotype, Spitzer type, half-tone, super lithography, and stochastic screening. So I hope you've been learning in the last move. You know what these terms mean. And as if that were not enough, we've got 16 frames of material on view, which have just been carefully assembling, including gumming, printing of gum, separation, and the printed roulette. And, of course, rouletting as well. And I would suggest that some of you might like to look again at the finished roulette towards the end of the display by the fireplace down there, and take a careful look at it, and compare that with the GB 1840, whatever it was, Treasury roulette, and you'll notice some significant correlation between the two. And that, of course, will bring you straight back round the cycle to the penny black, which we've been hearing about this afternoon during the talk. And it's a very interesting story, and one that I don't suppose many people have investigated in the way that Jeff has since printing of all that material stopped. I don't think Jeff's story will have finished, because we've got electronic printing going on. There are two post and go machines in London, and those of you who are interested should go to Farringdon Road or Clapham Common, and there you'll find a machine that works barely a few days a month because it keeps breaking down. Well, you can put an order in for a different tariff and it'll print off labels one at a time or 50 at a time, and they're all prepaid. And my understanding is that Jeff might be able to do a complete display on gumming, but we've got an interesting innovation coming up next year when stamps are going to be fragmented. That is to say, they're like these labels you can get off the counter printers, but you won't be able to peel the stamps off and reuse them. So we are into developing technology the whole time. And I do thank Jeffrey on your behalf for going into some of these areas with us, giving us ample examples to have a look at, very fine demonstration and PowerPoint presentation, and I would ask you all to join with me in showing our appreciation.
Well, Jeff, I know how much effort, work, thought, preparation's gone into this. It's been immense. It's taken a long time and a lot of time, I think, just putting the actual presentation itself together. I don't know whether I was supposed to take those pieces out of the envelope and leave them there for people to come and look at, but this is Jeff's very neat handiwork to show that engraving is not dead. I think that's a piece of household piping, but I'm not absolutely certain. Out of Harrods, right. Beautifully engraved. I'm not sure what the other piece came from, but it's... that's a piece of brass, is it?
Yes, it's,
yeah.
I think it's supporting brass. It may be engraved as brass.
Anyway, it's there to be looked at. Jeff, it's my great pleasure to present you with the Society's plaquette. I think it's got the right name on it. Yes, it has, and the date. There you are. Congratulations. Now, the display will stay up here for another 20 minutes or so, and you're invited downstairs for nibbles and for Jeff's carefully specified Rioja. Special Reserva. Which I hope you will enjoy. The next meeting is a 1 p.m. meeting in 2 weeks' time today. 2 weeks today, Renata Springer is bringing over Savoy and Leipzig, and I think that will be a very fine display of European material. So we look forward to seeing you and many others on that occasion. Thank you for coming.